Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte. Episode 81 for August 8th, 2009. OpenStreetMap.org. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time to cover all things floss, and we ain't talking dental floss here. We're talking free Libre open source software with the guru, the man who wrote Learning Perl, the king of Seaside, Mr. Squeak himself, Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Leo, good to talk to you again.
Mr. Squeak himself.
I love that. Just because I'm on the Squeak Advisory Board, amongst all the other things that I do, like Linux Fund and all that, and that doesn't make me Mr. Squeak. There are plenty of people who squeak a lot more than I do.
And Mrs. Squeak is still in the wings.
So. Who knows? Who knows? Wings, wow. We have wings?
Waiting in the look over there in the wings. Hey, I'm interested in this next topic, and it's funny because this is an open source project I had no idea existed until coincidentally about 2 weeks ago when I bought an app for the iPhone that instead of having Google Maps or Yahoo Maps or MSN Maps in it, had something called OpenStreetMap, and then a cycle app that had OpenCycleMap, and these maps were great, and they had things that Google didn't have, like bicycle trails on it, and I thought, wow, who are... Well, coinkydink, Randall, you got the guy who started all this on the show today.
Well, I do got to say that, you know, Floss, the whole point of the Floss show is to bring on open source software. And most of our shows have been about software, about people working together, creating programs and stuff. But occasionally we do talk about other things like open source hardware. And today's show is, again, a little bit different from our open source software show. And then we're talking about open data, data that's being collaborated on, gathered, like, say, the data for Wikipedia, the actual, you know, the text and the articles of Wikipedia aren't really software, it's data. So we have with us today Steve Coast, who is the creator of the OpenStreetMaps project, which, as far as I understand, is a bunch of people collaborating Wikipedia style on having every square inch of the earth mapped so that you can have maps that are independent of the copyrighted data that you would get with, say, Google Maps or Yahoo Maps or whatever, completely independent of that and useful for all sorts of different projects.
I love this idea. I'm going to ask him. You might say, well, we already have Google Maps. What do we need this for? Let's get Steve on the line. So from San Francisco, the city invented for bicyclists, Steve Coast is on the line via Skype. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Floss Weekly.
Hi. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I said bicyclists because I have two applications on my iPhone that use OpenStreetMaps, but it's not just for bicycling. Is that right? Is he thinking?
Sorry, you just broke up. So OpenStreetMap, No, definitely it's not just for bike. It's for, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer calling it OpenStreetMap, but
that was the
choice I made when I started it.
Yeah, tell us.
So the best way to think of OpenStreetMap is like Wikipedia, but for maps. So instead of companies collecting this data in a sort of top-down way, the way that Encyclopedia Britannica sort of farmed out the work to create all those articles in the encyclopedia, you just get volunteers going around with GPSs, with aerial imagery, or just bits of paper and a pencil. And they go and collect the map data for you, enter it into a big, vast database just like Wikipedia, and then we give it all away for free, just like Wikipedia.
And why? I mean, we've got Google Maps. What do we need an open source version of this for?
Well, the first thing to understand about Google Maps is that Google doesn't actually own the map. They license it from people like TeleAtlas and Navtech, who are the sort of duopoly who own all the map data, just like Microsoft and Yahoo do. And then they have a certain set of license considerations, and then they can give you that that data for free, where free means you have to use their service, the map's colored a certain way, you can't go in and fix things, you can't print out 1,000 copies for your friends, all the same kind of restrictions as maybe Microsoft Encarta putting their encyclopedia online compared to Wikipedia. Mm. So OpenStreetMap is you know, a step beyond the maps that you're used to online.
So you mean, so technically I couldn't take I couldn't take a Google map image of, you know, here's how to get to my house and make copies of that for thousands of people then, right?
Put it on a poster and put it in the post office. You know, I know when we want to use it on the air, for instance, it's very, very expensive. You know, CNN pays a lot to have that privilege.
Yeah, there's very large minimum fees for doing things. And you find that the use cases for what you can do are very thinly sliced because, you know, these guys have a lot of different businesses to protect. Maps are used in your car. They're used for fleet tracking. They use online and in paper. And so the big companies try and segment that. So if you try and do something that looks like you're doing fleet tracking online, that's going to be incredibly expensive. If you want to use it in a big cool, like commercial organization like CNN and you want reliability, that's going to be incredibly expensive and so on. And we sort of sweep all that away by just, you know, making the map data available. And then we move on from that because we not only sort of tick all those boxes, but then the maps where we have mappers, and, you know, we've been growing for 5 years now, where we have maps, they're often far better than what you can get elsewhere because we have the community. In the same way that Wikipedia just tracks stories quicker, has faster updates, and so on.
Now, that seems amazing to me because I know that these companies that do the mapping officially are paying lots and lots of people and, you know, hiring aerial photographs and things like that to, and licensing government databases and stuff. And so you're telling me that individuals working in the OpenStreetMap community are generating better maps than that?
Oh, absolutely. So if we think about the way that those guys do it, Teleatlas and Navtech literally have hundreds of trucks, and these trucks are expensive. They're bright yellow. They have an expensive GPS unit in them, and they have a couple of guys in there that are driving around every single road in the US and Europe and Canada and so on every year or so, every year to 2 years. They drive down every road, and they capture all the street numbers. They capture the house names. They capture whether a street is one way, all that kind of information. And that's very, very expensive, and it's a logistical problem. And fundamentally, the guys who are driving around, you know, they're not from your road. They don't care whether they get it right or not to a certain degree, right? Whereas if it's you going out there mapping, you're going to really care whether it's right or wrong.
I'll vouch for that because I use your maps, and they're very accurate for my little town, which I know very well. They're excellent. What percentage have you got mapped? I mean, how, if this is all volunteers, it must, I mean, how long has this been going on and how much have you got?
So OpenStreetMap started nearly 5 years ago. It was August 9th, 2004. We have 140,000 people in the project now. It's been growing exponentially since the beginning. And these people are all over the world, although there's a lot of concentration in Western Europe and the US and so on. In terms of what we've mapped, that's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. There's different ways to measure completeness, and maps are never complete because the things are always changing. We have a bunch of different ways that we can measure that, but in order to really do it, we would need to compare ourselves to Teleatlas or Navtech maps, and of course, we don't have that data in order to do those comparisons. There have been some academic papers comparing us to Teleatlas and so on in the UK and in Germany. And, you know, it's the high 90s for a lot of the figures. And you can think of completeness in terms of, you know, both do we have all the roads? Are they up to date and so on? But also, because of the nature of the data, we're not collecting the same stuff as Teleatlas and Navtech because they can only drive around these big expensive trucks. That means it's hard for them to collect things like footpaths, right? Or lots of different points of interest, whereas people on the ground who know their area and love going out with a GPS can capture far more detailed maps than you'll get from the traditional suppliers.
Which is one reason these are great for bicyclists, because you've got, you know, bicycle paths that are absolutely, I know, not on Google Maps.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's, whenever you look at OpenStreetMap, what you're looking at is a sort of pictorial representation of the data behind it. And there's too much data to show you on any one map. It would be too crowded. So we create a set of different views, and OpenCycleMap, especially, that's opencyclemap.org, I think, highlights things that are of interest to cyclists, like where bike shops are and where bike parking is, and then also where the bike routes are. And then there are active efforts in pretty much every country in the world to add the local and national official bike routes, and often those are proprietary, so we have to recapture them ourselves. And then also where cyclists just know that there are good bike routes that aren't on official maps.
This is really neat. I'm kind of blown away that this even exists. I have to confess, Steve, I didn't know it existed until I saw it on my iPhone.
It's a big thing that we're trying to push in the States. I mean, to give some background, grounds. The rest of the world tends to have map agencies which own all of the mapping data. So in Britain, for example, there's this thing called the Ordnance Survey, and it's funded by taxpayers, and also they can compete in the private domain. And they own all of the map data for the whole country. And they're pretty much a monopoly in that position. So, you know, that model is the same throughout the world. And that means that very basic map data is just not available. Whereas in the US, the federal government isn't allowed to take copyright on stuff it releases. So there are a few things in public domain, such as there's this thing called the Tiger data set, which is a map of the whole US released by the Census Bureau. It's not a very good map, but it's good enough to take a lot of the sort of bottom slack out of things. And that's one of the things we imported initially, and now we're going through fixing every road in the US and connecting them correctly, putting addressing on there, adding parks, all that kind of stuff. So here in the US, OpenStreetMap hasn't taken off as quickly because there hasn't been quite the same need. But now we've imported Tiger, it's really just it's on fire.
Now, there's some parts of Tiger that are out of date, and you're making changes to them. Volunteers are making changes to them. Is any of that data wanted back by the Tiger Project?
So it's funny. It's a lot of the organizations that we talk to, in fact, don't really want the data back because from their point of view, it's a bit like, you know how for how long Encyclopedia Britannica pushed back against Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing. So these guys are set up in a very top-down kind of way. If you have to be a surveyor with a capital S, you have to have a very expensive GPS, you have to have a fluorescent jacket. Otherwise, you're just incapable of collecting data. Right? So, you know, we would love to have really great, you know, reciprocal relationships with a lot of these guys. But, you know, the Census Bureau, they just recently spent an awful lot of your money equipping tens of thousands of people to go and remap the whole US with very expensive GPS tablet PCs. Mm. And eventually that's going to come back to us because they're going to release much of that data into the public domain. But you know, you've got to think that the mentality is going to take a long time to change, just like it did with Encyclopedia Britannica.
I mean, it's similar to, say, a software application forking. When a distro forks and becomes a second distro, whether the changes then go back upstream, in which we have the same problem here, but it's data instead of programs.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
We did exactly that. So, for example, in the Netherlands, there was a fantastic company called AND, who are one of the largest map suppliers in the world. And they donated the entire Netherlands to us, and we imported all of that map data into OpenStreetMap. And I had a meeting with them like a few months after we'd done it, and I showed them OpenStreetMap, and they were saying, well, that's not our map. And it's like, why do you think that? It's like, well, you've added the footpaths, you've fixed a lot of the one-way streets, there's buildings in there, there's points of interest. Like, well, it was your data. We've just improved it, right? And it did fork, and it improved very substantially.
Wow.
I love it that they gave you the Netherlands. I wish somebody would give me the Netherlands.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, this old sort of open source mantra of the stone soup and different people bringing different things to the table. So we have some people bring the Netherlands, and we have a data set here. Then we have points of interest in Ireland, and we're sort of building this sort of Frankenstein map of importing data, something that wasn't quite possible with Wikipedia to do. And then we're merging it all together and getting the community to fix it and blend it together.
Is there any concern about quality or, you know, errors and that kind of thing? I guess like Wikipedia itself corrects.
Yeah, so there's two ways I usually answer that question. When I'm asked usually in a conference, I'll ask the audience when someone says this, okay, guys, so how many of you have used Encyclopedia Britannica or Microsoft Encarta, which has actually gone bust now, in the last 3 years? And you'll get, you know, 3-4 hands go up out of like a few hundred people. And then you say, how many of you have used Wikipedia in the last few days?
Everybody.
And everybody's hands.
Yeah.
So that's a very flippant way of turning it around. Exactly. That's a very flippant way of turning it around. But to really specifically answer you, where we have people, our maps are always universally better. The only times we have problems are in a few different countries like the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, where there's a couple of different governments that disagree fairly fundamentally over what the names of towns and roads are. And there, we don't even have a problem with people disagreeing of whether the road exists. We don't even really have people disagreeing over the idea that the roads might have different names depending on which invading army you believe.
Right.
But people just flip the names around, whether which one is going to appear first. And we have those kind of problems. And we're going to see that in places, probably in border regions like in Kashmir and Pakistan and North and South Korea and so on.
I never thought of that. Those disputes like happen in Wikipedia as well, but they're not as common on maps.
Exactly, because we don't have the problem of having to find a neutral point of view. We can both agree that San Francisco exists, right? so we sidestep a lot of those issues.
Do you have like an overseeing board then that sort of reviews a lot of the things, or is that really up to the user community to review other people's contributions?
Yeah, at the moment, it's very bottom-up like that. I mean, the project's philosophy has always been to cross bridges when you come to them. So we start simple, and we just fix things. And, you know, we've only really seriously started encountering these problems in the last maybe 6 to 12 months. And we formed a little committee within a foundation. There's a foundation that supports OpenStreetMap. And there's a little committee in there that deals with things like people importing copyrighted data, because we definitely don't want it, of course. And then things where we get user disputes over people, you know, deleting other people's data, or where we have these factual disputes, such as in the Turkish Republic and Northern Cyprus. But mostly, you know, out of our huge community, we get along remarkably well for an open source project.
I like how you said you have to cross the bridge before you come to it. You have to draw the bridge in before you can cross it and come to it.
It's almost a tragic loss, because if you go back and think about the start of OpenStreetMap, the entire world was a blank canvas, right?
Yeah.
We didn't even have the coastlines of the major continents or anything. And so there was a, you know, that both put a lot of people off because they said this was just going to be impossible. But also it challenged a lot of people, because as soon as you're adding the data, you're seeing the map expand on an hourly and daily basis. But now, as we've been completing many, many countries and filling in, there's, you know, each individual is having slightly less impact. It's a bit like now you're getting people fixing sentences and so on and spelling mistakes in Wikipedia, as opposed to writing the articles in the first place. But there's a really great trade-off, because as the map has got better, of course, it's a lot more valuable and usable to a lot of people. So we inherit lots more people because of that.
Now, how do you go about fixing things in here, though? I mean, I actually have a very specific example. I for some reason, the street that's about two blocks away from my home was penciled in many years ago as going all the way straight through. And although that street was never built, it shows up on Yahoo Maps, Google Maps, everybody. And so every time I do a routing from my home, it goes, oh, you want to take this street, but that's right through the back of people's yards. And in fact, I just looked on OpenStreetMaps and it's still wrong. It's probably still the Tiger data, which is still wrong. Now, how much do I need to learn in order to be able to make that street be broken into two pieces like it actually is?
So we continually try and push the barriers lower to make OpenStreetMap easier and easier for people. We're not by any means there yet. It's not perfect. But today, the way you would do it is you're looking at the map in OpenStreetMap, and you'll see along the top there's a series of tabs, and one of those is Edit. And it's supposed to look just like Wikipedia. So you're viewing the map and you edit the map, just like in Wikipedia, you're viewing and editing an article. You click Edit, you find your road, you click on it, and you delete it, which in this case I believe is Shift Backspace. And that's just to stop you accidentally hitting backspace and deleting things.
Now, how do I know it's shift backspace? Is there instructions somewhere near the edit button?
Yeah, so at the bottom there's a help section, and we have a very big wiki with screencasts and shortcut keys, explanations, and all sorts of stuff.
This is so cool. I can't even believe it. I'm just floored.
So it's all Web 2.0, though. I mean, I'm sitting there being able to interact with it. Yeah. I'm not having to go out to some other application that's a drawing program or something just to upload the data.
Yeah, exactly. So what you're seeing when you click edit is Yahoo very kindly donate their aerial imagery to us so that we can draw on top of aerial pictures effectively. But that's one way of getting data in. You can also just walk around, you know, with a GPS in places like where hiking trails, where the tree coverage might not let you be able to see the footpaths. Or you can use just a pen and paper and then come back and enter the data manually.
So I have I carry a GPS dongle with me every day as I'm traveling around, just in case I want to shoot some photos and want to have them geotagged properly. So every morning I grab my GPS dongle, put it in my pocket, and travel around with it all day.
You need an orange vest, and you too can be a mapper.
But I'm thinking that one of these times I must have driven on the road as it actually exists. So I could actually take that and overlay that particular GPS track and draw with that in OpenStreetMap?
Yes, exactly. And it's really not a hard thing to do. You have to make sure that your GPS is recorded enough data that it's recording like about once every 1 or 2 seconds, so that you get this sort of trail of dots like Hansel and Gretel dropping breadcrumbs behind them. And then you can just treat it just like any other image to draw on top of and just say, look, this is a road. Its name is this. Its classification is this. There's a cycle lane on the left-hand side and so on and so on.
Wow, that is pretty simple. And
another way you can learn is that all around the world, we run these things called mapping parties. And they're a bit like a Linux install fest, maybe. But the idea is you come along on a Saturday morning or afternoon to like a town hall or an REI store or something like that. We give you a GPS unit. We show you how to use it. We show you how to use OpenStreetMap. And then you go out and you map something that's of interest to you. Because everyone's interested in different things.
Right? I want to do this. I've got a dongle.
We should run one.
You should run one. Well, so do you have them in the Bay Area? Do you have? I mean, you must.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at our wiki at wiki.openstreetmap.org, you'll see a big list of mapping parties all over the place. And then, so once you've gone out and you've mapped that stuff that's interesting, you come back and we'll show you how to get that data on the map. And really, you know, the idea is to get you addicted, because as soon as you start trying to fix this thing, it's an addictive process.
Where do you need help? What areas of the world do you need help besides Turkey?
Besides Turkey. We really all over the US. I mean, the simplest way to look at it is, you know, what matters to you, to look at the right map, and if there's anything missing or wrong, just start fixing it very, very simply. We need people, you know, very frankly, all over the world. But each one of those people has a different motivation for mapping. Like we've mentioned cycling, but there's a lot of people who are interested in genealogy. There's a lot of people who just want to use the data for other cool projects, right? There's a lot of hikers. And so I don't want to classify it too much and exclude people, because really whatever it is you want to map, you can put it on there. There's a few very minor exceptions. Like we don't particularly want, you know, the route your 747 took to Europe, because, you know, we're really looking at...
Well, you really shouldn't be leaving the GPS on during the flight anyway.
Yes,
I've
for the
never
giant
done
sky bridge.
So are there any limitations to how I can use the data at openstreetmap.org?
So we're under a Creative Commons attribution share alike license. So that's about as open as you could get. All it means is if you use the data, please just say where it came from. And if you make any changes, please release those changes. It's that simple.
That's our license as well.
Now you mentioned Yahoo earlier, and I like the fact that they've given you the rights to use their aerial images below the at least places that Yahoo's got images for. But I also know that there's another relationship you have with Yahoo. They've started using some OpenStreetMap maps for some of their actual maps, right?
Yeah, especially Flickr. So where they don't have map data from traditional suppliers, because, you know, another fallout from relying on a series of big, expensive yellow trucks is that it's hard to get those trucks to go and map, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, or, you know, drive them around various different places. And they're hard to move, they're hard to manage, and so on. So there's a lot of places in the world which either, because there's logistical concerns, they can't map, or because they're not economically viable, right? Because, you know, mapping India right now is not as cost-effective as putting resources into mapping the US, right? So there's a lot of places that just either don't have map data or the map data is really, really bad. And so we still map those areas because to us there's no particular difference. We're still using the same low-cost ideas. And so people like Flickr use those maps where Yahoo is unable to provide those Navtech or TeleAtlas-derived maps. Some good examples might be Tehran in Iran or Baghdad in Iraq. But of course, it's far broader than that. They have a big list of countries where they're using OpenStreetMap, so I can't mention every one, but those are a couple of interesting examples.
Yeah, I really like the fact that because the Tehran maps were switched over from their commercial supplier to OpenStreetMaps, people have more higher resolution for them to do Flickr images, like it really was this street corner, rather than being sort of just generically out in that blob of area.
Yeah, absolutely, because you've got to think of, you know, Flickr's just all about the user experience, so they want you to overlay where your maps are with your photos, and they want that to have meaning. And if it's just a blank canvas because they have no map data, then it's not going to make a bunch of sense to have these like little pictures on there. Whereas even basic road data, like the outline of towns and so on, brings a lot of context to it, and OpenStreetMap can provide that.
Amazing. And so you're actually doing humanitarian work. Did you realize that when you started this?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's been a roller coaster of 5 years. We've done an awful lot of stuff, and the maps are just used in new and unexpected ways all the time. I mean, one thing that happened was I do this a lot. I sit down with someone and I explain to them what OpenStreetMap is, and they say, well, show me where some good maps are. And I turn it around and I say, well, where would you like to see the maps? And so this one guy said to me, well, let's have a look at Cuba. Let's look at Havana. And so I had to stop and say, well, look, we've got good maps in like England and Germany and America and Spain and so on, but there's no reason to expect that we're going to have good maps there, as a sort of caveat. And then you zoom in and Havana is one of our best map places in the world.
Who knew?
It's insane. You should have a look. I mean, it's just incredible. And there's a real feedback effect. There's a snowball here, right? Because once the maps are a little bit better, that means they're a bit more usable to more people. And once they're a bit more usable, there's more people that add the map data. More people add my map data, you get more people. And this feedback effect very, very rapidly is filling in, you know, huge sections of the world with map data.
Do you have traffic routing information, like the fact that a road is one way or that you can only turn right at an intersection?
Absolutely. So the data model behind OpenStreetMap is very, very, very versatile in that it allows to do things like the display maps that you're looking at now, but also underlying that there's topology in the vector data. So we know where streets are connected or not. We know whether a street is one way. There are different ways of saying whether there are turn restrictions there, or whether something has a stop sign or traffic lights, what the speed limits are, all of that kind of metadata that you need. Now, you know, this is a work in progress. It's not fixed and fully done yet. Give it a couple of years and we'll have done the entire planet. But right now, there's a huge amount of data in that. And we encourage more and more people to add stuff that move it on from just being an incredibly good display map to also being, you know, a fantastically usable data set that you could use in your car, just like you use a TomTom, for example.
Have people built routing applications on top of the OSM data?
Oh yeah, there's several. I mean, the project is, you know, it's open source. So there's not just one routing project. There's like 20, each one in a different language using different database styles and so on. Yes, there are many different routing systems out there.
That's so really, I could enter an address and enter another address into some interface, and it would use OSM data to get me from one place to the other?
Exactly. Like one of those is called Open Route Service, and they allow you to just drag pins around very simply. The next level of detail is us adding all of the address data. So you know, what you're looking at, you're seeing a great display map, but there's a lot of rich information behind that, such as things like turn restrictions. And we're adding in addresses all over the world right now. And that is something, again, that's made easier because, you know, they're moving from a blank canvas to having where all the roads are was one step. The next step is now we have all the roads. Now we just have to get everyone to say where all the street numbers are, which is actually a far easier problem because you don't need to go out anymore. You can sit at home and just tap in the street numbers of where you are, where you live, that kind of thing. And there are lots of data sets, such as the U.S. Census Bureau's Tiger data has not particularly great, but good enough address data for the whole country that we're importing as well.
I'm looking at the cycle map. You've got in my area, you've got topographical information. It looks like a USGS map. I mean, this is incredible. And that's all because of the cheap and widely available GPS, I would guess. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That topographic information with the contours and the hill shading and so on, that comes from a shuttle mission called the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, where they threw up a shuttle with a big radar on it, and they covered, you know, a large section of the world horizontally and vertically to, I think it's 90 meters accuracy, and then and then height-wise it's 30, if I remember.
So this was not contributed by your users. This was contributed by the NASA.
Yes, and it's of the whole world, and it's in the public domain. Great. And there's an even higher resolution data set that this is derived from, but only the CIA gets to see that, unfortunately.
This is good enough for me. Great for a cyclist.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, you're looking at the Bay Area. It adds a lot of context, right? You can see why the roads go round, why they curve that way, because they're going around a hill or down a valley, that kind of thing.
You sure?
It's super useful. And, of course, you know, the next step really is to move to a better level within, for example, the city of San Francisco, right, where that topological data is not high enough resolution to see it every block, but knowing whether you're going to be cycling up 45 degrees or down 45 degrees is incredibly important, right, for things like cycle routing. And it's only really the community that's going to be able to enter this data in a useful way. I believe.
Now, how do you access this data? I mean, obviously the OpenStreetMap.org site is doing it directly. It's got the databases sitting right next to it. Are these other sites downloading the entire database and working from that? Or are there APIs where I could say, give me everything within this LatLon grid and of these flavors?
Yeah, all of the above. So every week we release a data set called planet.osm. And it's just a very, very big compressed XML file with everything in the entire planet. And that you can find at planet.openstreetmap.org. And it's a very, very simple XML file format. And there are many, many tools to play with it and turn it into the kind of display maps you're seeing. And all the documentation is available on the wiki. And then every minute, I think it's every minute, we're emitting diffs. So everything that's happened in the last minute gets emitted. And you can apply that to your data set, and there are tools to do that as well. So you can remain in sync with OpenStreetMap very, very quickly. I don't know how big the uncompressed data set is. It's measured in the tens or hundreds of gigabytes, I'm pretty sure. It's hard to keep track as the project is growing so fundamentally.
And probably then something around 160 API, gig. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just seeing the chat room, 160 gig uncompressed. So, yes, huge.
Okay. So then there's a very flexible RESTful API, which allows you to do things like change individual streets, change individual points of interest, grab all the area, all the data in a bounding box, or grab all the data in a bounding box that meets some criteria, like give me all the cycle routes in this bounding box, or just give me all the data, those kinds of things. And it's all very, very simple and very, very flexible.
So this would be like an iPhone app might use that API rather than downloading the entire 160 gig, which isn't going to fit on the iPhone. They're actually using real-time queries to your APIs.
Exactly, to get the data or the map tiles. That, you know, to come back to that iPhone point, that's really important because, you know, these guys, Teleatlas and Navtech, have such incredibly restrictive licenses that if you have like a 3-inch screen device that's connected, you get this license. If it's a 4-inch device that doesn't have power, it's this license. And they have these thinly sliced licenses to protect their business models. And that really hurts the iPhone because most of the mapping providers don't allow you to use their maps in your applications. They either will have very harsh licensing restrictions, like you can't cache on the device, or they want to charge you an awful lot of money. Or they don't allow your use case. For example, allowing live GPS data on top of a map is usually a big no-no because they're protecting their fleet tracking business, which is incredibly big. So OpenStreetMap fills a big need in the iPhone applications because we're pretty much, you know, one of the very few numbers of maps they can use in a, you know, developer-friendly, open bottom-up kind of way.
Yeah, I'm using a program called Bicycle on the and it's using OpenStreetMap. I can see your logo right there. And that makes sense. So they weren't able to afford it and probably didn't want to suffer the restrictions they would have. So they simply go to OpenStreetMap, and as long as they attribute it. Now, this is a commercial use. I had to pay for this program. Do they pay you some money for the use of this?
So that's interesting. Then we get into like the commercialization of OpenStreetMap. I don't know that application, but they're probably not. Now, OpenStreetMap provides a tile server, and you should think of that tile server that people are using a bit like the Linux source code is available. And then the companies came along and provided services around it. Companies like Red Hat and SUSE and so on, right? So actually I co-founded a company called CloudMade, which is VC funded in the Bay Area. And we provide a bunch of services around OpenStreetMap on top of what you can get for free. So it's just like Linux. If you want to go and build your own tile server, your own geocoder, you want to do your own routing, you want to do all this stuff, build your own applications, you're welcome to do so. The data is there. But if you want some help, just like Red Hat provides all those kind of services around Linux, we can help you with the map. So if you wanted those tile services, for example, that would be one of the things we do.
By the way, even Havana map even goes down to cemetery plots. So if you're looking for a cemetery plot in Havana, may I recommend openstreetmap.org? It's amazing.
Does it show you where all the 1957 cars are?
They haven't yet added that, but I'm sure that's just around the corner. Would you ever add a street view kind of feature to this? Is that something that you've contemplated?
So there's there's a project called Open Street View, which is just really getting started right now to do exactly that, filling in all those different gaps.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually, you know, quite a fun project. There's pretty much anyone with a bit of spare time and six cameras could could hook together a laptop to do Street View themselves. The cost there is going to be, you know, all that gas driving around. I mean, just think, because you're not just driving a couple of roads, you'd have to drive to every intersection in San Francisco, for example.
Oh, but it'd be so much fun to have kind of like a jerry-rigged Street View car driving around.
What kind of infrastructure is behind all this?
That's what I wanted to know.
What are you writing the code in? What kind of machines are you running? Are you got like 100 machines in the cloud, or how is this all being done?
Sure. So OpenStreetMap's been through a number of evolutions. Like I wrote the first, I think it was four versions of it. And today it's written mostly in Ruby on Rails at the back end for the website itself. That's running on a number of machines with a very large Postgres database behind it, which has all the user information, all of the street data. And of course, not only that, it also has all the history data, because when you move a street, it doesn't actually delete the data. It keeps it like a wiki does. And all of those servers reside in London at the university I used to go to, University College London, and is managed by a pretty crack team of volunteer sysadmins who make sure that it's ticking on a daily basis.
And then the coding is all Ruby. The interface, when I'm using the interface, I'm using Ruby on Rails there.
Yes, you're using a bunch of different things. The server side is all Ruby on Rails, but then there's a bunch of JavaScript that is making that map slide around.
Right. It's very Ajax-y.
Exactly. Then the map tiles themselves are produced by an Apache plugin called ModTile, which is all written in C and talks to a slightly different database and is rendering those tiles with a very large cache on the fly as well. So there's a bunch of different bits and pieces there that bring it all together.
I love that you have four different renders on here: Mapnik, Osmo Render, Cycle Map, and No Name. I don't know what No Name means.
So yeah, I can go through those. Mapnik is a server side. Again, everything's open source. Server side rendering infrastructure that produces the map that you see when you first have a look.
That's the default.
It produces maps. Yeah, of equivalent quality to that you see on Google and Bing and Yahoo and
better.
So
look at this. This is Toronto. I don't know, for those of you watching at home, I mean, this is spectacular. It looks a lot
prettier
than Google. Yeah, it's a lot prettier, a lot more information.
There's a fantastic guy up there called Richard Wirtz, who lives near the city and runs mapping events and
incredible.
To produce that data. And then Osmo Render is actually a distributed service. So there are many people out on the internet who go to the Osmo Render server and say, hey, what needs rendering? And they might say Toronto. And then that machine will download the Toronto data, render it using a lot of SVG, and then upload those tiles to the server again. So that's distributed.
Interesting.
Then the cycle map is actually using Mapnik, but it just highlights things of interest to cyclists.
Right.
And then No Names is one of the things that we use to help mappers find out where there are bugs. So in the same way you might use Lint, for example, on your C code or something to highlight, you know, where you've missed a semicolon or you should have done this or that. We can highlight on the map common mistakes, like you haven't connected two roads together or
that's what these red things are.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So those are roads that are actually missing names. So people have drawn them in from aerial imagery, but we don't know the name. So if you know the name of it, you could quickly click edit, go and fix that.
Everybody, come on. Let's make it perfect. and now we have two overlays. There's map, lint, and data.
Yeah.
What do those do?
So map lint is takes the no names layer a step beyond and adds a bunch more extra information beyond just streets that have no name. So it talks about more of the errors I talked about before, like roads that are very close together but not connected, or points of interest that don't seem to have any attributes.
Right.
And then data starts to let you explore the data that's in there. So when you click the data thing, you can then click on roads and find out who edited it, when,
this is remarkable.
What time they edited it, what the parameters of it are, and so on. And that allows you to explore in a bit more depth too.
This is great. And it's warning me. It says, you've clicked an area that has 148 bits of data. Some browsers are not going to be happy. I should probably be using Chrome if I wanted to make that one work.
Wow.
But OpenStreetMap is really... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, so besides people that are doing mapping that can help you out, are you looking for people to help you with infrastructure things like programmers, tech writers, things like that?
Oh, we love coders. I mean, OpenStreetMap has a really deep philosophy of code is king, right? We have a lot of people with a lot of great ideas, and we really respect people who who come to the table who with ideas and the code, right? So anyone who's willing to hack on it, we would love to have you. We need people competent in pretty much every area of coding you can think of in the open source world. So we need people who can hack on the Ruby on Rails backend. We need people who can, you know, make our JavaScript better. We need people with C to make our tile rendering better. And, you know, we're pretty welcoming community. But there is a little bit of barrier to entry because, you know, we've built a pretty vast infrastructure over the last 5 years. But we're very, very interested in helping people overcome that and then getting people involved in helping us.
Do you need translators? Do you need people that are taking, like, the street map names and adding, like, the localization names for those?
Yeah, so actually, we just launched internationalization on the site itself. So if you come to OpenStreetMap in a browser that's configured for French or Spanish or whatever, it will be in your language, and that's an ongoing effort to convert to as many languages as possible. I think we're up to like 32 languages or something by now. So we need translation both within the website, within the tools, and then of course the street names themselves.
Wow, cool!
I'm just loving this. It makes me just want to run outside and write some numbers down or something.
Go
ahead. No.
I just saw you on the wiki. The wiki is a very deep resource. There's some
I'm looking
great
at it.
Tools on there. There's a calendar on there with events to find people speaking at events near you or different mapping parties. There's some simple stuff that tells you about the status. There's an image of the week, and that's a great section where every week we have a different picture highlighting something new in OpenStreetMap, and there's always something new. There's new maps. There's new stuff going on. There's, you know, one of the amazing things we had that was actually at our conference, which I could talk about a little bit, is someone's made a Braille map. So obviously, you know, if you don't have good eyesight, then paper maps aren't necessarily good for you. So these people have been using OpenStreetMap data to make brass tactile maps that you can put up behind you and so on to figure out where they are. And that's actually one of the images of the week. And of course, we go through, you know, there's screencasts, there's tools, there's discussions on forums. We have a very large community. You know, all the usual trappings of an open source project, like an IRC room and so on.
What's your Twitter handle?
That's just at OpenStreetMap.
Okay. So people can also follow you there.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool.
So we've had three conferences so far every year, and the one we just had last month was in Amsterdam. We had 220 people from 27 different countries there. Most major companies were represented, all sections of the community and so on.
Looks like a big crowd and a nice crowd, too. That's great. State of the map.
And they're very organized into rows and columns.
it's amazing to see a project like this that, you know, has been going on for 4 or 5 years now and has produced such incredible results. I'm so glad we can kind of get it better known out there. Mm-hmm.
So do you really want to help us?
Yes.
Okay. What we need is people. We need to touch as many people as we can. So if you could mention it on Twitter, I will buy you a bottle of wine.
I will not only mention it on Twitter, I'll plug it. I'll tell people to come listen. And don't buy me a bottle of wine, but I'll tell people to come listen to this show and learn more about it and encourage people to get involved because this is great. And we got a few people who listen to this show.
Just a few.
Exactly.
We'll get a few more throughout the thing. I think this is so really neat. Because, you know, you think of Wikipedia immediately and it's such an obvious success. And you think, well, that's a way that this could happen. But you never think a map could be a collaborative thing. We just think of maps as being handed on down from high. But, of course, the best way to do a map is the same way you do a Wikipedia collaboratively. It just makes sense once you say it.
I mean, and we're sort of filling a hole in a way as well, because if you think about open source, it's conquered a lot of barriers, right? We have several great open source kernels. We now have great open source windowing systems. We now have great open source web browsers and word processors and so on. But now you reach a limit where you need something a bit more than software, because how would you produce an open source Google Earth? Well, the software is not really going to be very hard. There's lots of people who could do that. But then you need this vast database behind it that's going to make it fly, right? So we're filling one of those gaps. And I think open source in general is going to, once it fills out to the kind of level that we're reaching now, we're going to be missing a couple of things like various open data sets that we're going to need to crowdsource to be able to use them in the open source world.
Indeed. Well, everybody should tweet opensourcemap.org. I'm going to tweet it right now.
OpenStreetMap.
Open source map. And when you do it, make sure you do the URL wrong so that it's completely worth it. Please do it right. OpenStreetMap.org. And maybe we can just spread the word right now from everybody listening. Everybody get out there and Twitter about it. This is great. http://OpenStreetMap.org. Tell the world.
Very cool.
I love that. That's great. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see all the different ways people use it. And I think given the kind of the monolithic nature of Telenav and all these other big mapping companies, there's a great future for this. I can think of all sorts of ways. You know, Google Maps, the mashups showed you, how much people are interested in mapping and applying mapping information to other data sets. But it's such a limited data set compared to what you guys can do. This should be what people are doing all the mashups with. I presume you have a Google Maps-like API to this.
Yeah, so in fact, there's a whole open source API called OpenLayers, which allows you to pull in OpenStreetMap and many other mapping services. And it's a fantastic project, and it's really not that much harder. I suggest the easiest way for people to get involved is actually another project I was involved in early on called MapStraction. And MapStraction is a map wrapper API. So if you don't care whether you're using Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, OpenStreetMap, or whatever, you just talk to the MapStraction little JavaScript API, and it will make the map work for you so you can add pins, set the location, all that kind of stuff. Because there's a danger for people in getting locked in into one of those mapping APIs.
Yes. So this is a higher level interface to it. Yeah. Oh, this is great. And it's all in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Really neat. Now, we should ask you, because you brought this up before we began, you also, earlier on, before this, worked at Wolfram Alpha for a while.
Yeah, I was an intern at Wolfram Research when I was 18.
Oh, what a great way to start.
It's a fantastic company to work for.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Had they already been starting a Wolfram Alpha at that point? Or?
No, not by a long way. Yeah. But I got to tell you, it's, everyone thinks that Google has some smart employees until you've been to Wolfram Research.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite incredible.
I interviewed Stephen when Wolfram Alpha came out, and it just blew me away. This guy's thinking at a level way well beyond anything anybody else is thinking at. Just fascinating guy. Well, it's so great to have you on the show. We thank you so much for joining us, Steve. And thank you for starting this project.
Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah.
It's really good to talk about it and put it in the hands of more people.
Neat. And I'll plug it on Twit for you.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Steve Coast.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Good.
Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, man, I just want to get out there now. And now the wiki does have complete instructions if you're just starting out on how you could do this.
For even idiots like me.
Or me. If you're an idiot,
yeah, I know. I want to fix that street now. I want to go out this afternoon. I want to go take one of my GPS traces and do that. And I've also been uploading all my GPS traces to EveryTrail because I got the iPhone app for that. And I thought, well, I should probably then take all my GPS traces. Now, most of them are private, so I don't go look in there. But I do actually have some public GPS traces in EveryTrail, but I think I should probably take those public ones and put them over on.
They have logs. If you go, if you go to OpenStreetMap, you can see the logs that other people have put in there of their travels. And I think from now on, when I cycle, I'm gonna have to read the instructions here. But from now on, when I cycle, I'm gonna do whatever it is that I need to do to make this data of use. I have a logger that I got for that, like you did for my camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what are you using on the iPhone, and what is that for?
Well, there was an app that accessed EveryTrail, and it was free, and it was one of the first GPS loggers. So I just wanted to use that, and it was before I actually bought my GPS dongle. Now I have the GPS dongle, and that's all I use anyway. So I have the WinTech GPT-201 or whatever, the little tiny one.
Yeah.
That's really nice. And it gives me about a day and a half of charge. And I've been taking all my cruises and stuff, and so all my pictures are geotagged now, which is really, really cool. But also just so I could get used to using it and figuring out how accurate the trails are and when it might go bad, every time I leave the house, I put it in my pocket, and I run off with it, and every night I dump it out, and I've been just uploading those to EveryTrail, so I've actually got a huge history of trails, and The reason I put them on every trail is because it was free and I could put my GPX logs there in case I ever wanted them again.
So it's just a place where people upload their logs.
Yeah, but you can annotate it. You can tell stories about it. I mean, it's kind of cool. It's a nice little way. And then there's this application for the iPhone, which I no longer have on my iPhone because I've got 250 apps on there already.
Is there a limit?
I've got 1.2 gigabytes of downloaded apps on my phone now.
Holy
so,
cow.
it's pretty crazy. So every time I add one, I now have a rule that if I add one, I have to subtract two. So it's like, I'm trying to get this down to a slightly
I know.
Small
it's a,
size.
It's a bad habit. I'm addicted to this too. I just keep adding
more
apps.
I know, yeah. But you know, you never know which one of three hotel booking applications might give you the better
Precisely.
Hotel rate and you're stuck somewhere. So it's like, I don't want to not have to download those, especially as a couple of them were, you know, free for a couple of days, then go back to paid.
Right.
So I definitely want to make sure I have them on my phone just in case I need it at that point. So I'm pretty crazy with apps on my phone. That's pretty crazy. And I have, I would recommend though, GPS kit. It's about $10 for the iPhone. It was actually the best GPS application I've seen on there so far.
Oh, okay. Because
it does logging. It does logging and it knows how to keep the screen blank. So keep your power down.
That's
so if you don't
good.
Have your separate GPS logger, GPS kit for the iPhone, I think, is probably the best of breed for that.
Yeah,
so
people don't really need GPS loggers anymore.
No.
I guess it uses up your iPhone battery, so it's probably good to have a stable.
Well, and the problem is that if you get a phone call or
right.
you want to switch to a different app, because of the rule about no backgrounding,
right.
you're pretty much, no matter what you use for logging on your phone, you're going to get left in the dirt on that one. So
I'm going to look and see what's on Android. More and more, I'm kind of thinking Android's the, let's go open.
Right, you know? Right. You know, I was just wondering when he said that they gave you Netherlands, I wonder if you could go Dutch.
you're a very bad man, Randall Schwartz.
Speaking of bad men, can we go over some of the future guests before we run out of time today?
No, those are good men. Those are good men, yes. Who's coming up on the show?
On the very short list, we have, I believe it's next week, we have Michael Ford, who is the... Iron Python, one of the key members of the Iron Python project,
very
which is Python on the .NET platform,
yeah.
the CLR. Definitely want to talk to him about how he pigeonholes a dynamic language into something that's made for static typing. So that'll be sort of fun. Coming up immediately after that, we've got Jeffrey T. Darlington, the guy who draws the General Protection Fault comics, together with a couple of his buddies, talking about how they're using open source to make all those wonderful comics that you and I laugh at every week. Immediately after that, Eric Jung, working for the Mozilla Project, talking about Foxy Proxy and privacy issues. On the very short list, and this one's actually one that's shown up since last week, one of the legends. I mean, we've had, Ward Cunningham, we've had Dan Ingles on, you know, at least in terms of the software environment and stuff. We have agreed Kent Beck. Kent Beck is one of the guys that helped create the whole extreme programming thing and stuff. So he's going to talk about, you know, basically providing the framework in which a lot of these open source projects are able to do as much with as little resources they have. So he agreed. I'm just thrilled that he agreed to be on the show. Actually, it was great because he got pressure from tweets for Randall. I'm like, Kent, you got to be on Randall's show. So,
that's funny.
So my crowd, thank you, crowd, actually nudged him into accepting a slot on the show.
Good.
So that's very nice. Monty Wydenius, of course, MySQL Monty. Is going to come on shortly after that to talk about the whole MySQL MariaDB stuff and a lot of other people. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you can see the link to all the upcoming shows and the 180 names now I have.
Hey, you were working on Alan Kay. Any progress with getting him on?
I've asked a few more times and I just haven't gotten any response.
He's such a big shot. He'll never talk
I'm gonna,
to us.
Well, but Kent Beck is close. I mean, in terms of the
really?
Kind of
okay,
effects
good.
It's had on that sort of thing. I've 196 projects now. So
that should get us. Let's see. We've done daily. 81 episodes.
Yeah. Can we do Floss Week, Floss Daily? Because I think that's what it's going to take. It's just going to be
gonna clear
more,
this
and
one.
More and more and more on that.
You don't have to get to inbox guest zero, though. It's okay.
Apparently no. And I really do appreciate all the mail that you guys send me. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I stream live for my karaoke singing from time to time, including tonight. If you're watching live, I'll be doing karaoke. And as you hear this show on Saturday, hopefully, I'll probably also be doing it Saturday night as well. Also, coming up, I'm going to be, if you're in the Atlanta area or already planning on being at Dragon Con, I will be at Dragon Con a few weeks from now. That's the first weekend of September. So come by and say hello to me and say you're a Floss Weekly listener, and I will give you absolutely nothing except a smile. So thank you for coming up there.
And maybe an autograph if you ask really nice.
If you bring a book, I will, in fact, autograph books. Or, you know, if you want me to autograph your shirt or something, that's fine as well.
I have about eight of your books. I got to get them all autographed next time you're out.
I'm on the two traditional panels that I'm on every year, Hacker 101 and Hacker 201. Those are question and answer. I mean, Hacker 101 gets usually about 100 people, which is great. They're in there asking all sorts of questions about, you know, various things from what's a blue box all the way up to, you know, how do I keep people from breaking into my machine? And I'm mostly just the color commentary. So somebody will ask a question. Somebody else, one of the smarter people, will answer the question. And then I'll just sort of add some jokes. So it usually works out pretty well. Like one time somebody asked a question. One of the panelists said, after thinking for a second, the short answer is no. And so I leaned over to the mic and went, the long answer is no. I didn't really know what the answer was, but I thought that would be a good time to that joke. So. And then I'm also on the Obama report card panel, which I don't know why I'm on that one, except they always throw something random at me to make me research it. And it's about, you know, Obama's first 9 months in office. How well is he doing with regard to cybersecurity and things like that? So I'm going to be talking about a lot of cool computer related things down there.
Lovely.
And it's hot Atlanta in September. What a better place to go.
Eek. Lovely.
I'll be inside most of the time anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, so, yeah. My friend, sounds like you are a busy, busy guy. I'm glad you're around because you're making this show take off.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for, again, providing the infrastructure, using that word one more time in this show, for me to be able to invite cool people to come talk with us and share their points of view.
This one. I just thought it was so cool.
It is. It is. Yeah. And who knew? And this one actually all came about in the last 2 weeks. So, again, one of these places where, you know, the right thing, the right person talks to the right person, somebody nudges me and I go, oh, yeah, great idea for a show. So here we go.
Well, we're going to get it on Twitter and we're going to really let the world know about OpenStreetMap.org.
Indeed.
Randall Schwartz, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.